And we return on this Monday afternoon. It's today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman. How are you, Bonnie?
Good, good. And you?
Very well. Well, this hour we chat with attorney and writer Gregory Wallance. He's the author of America's Soul in Balance, The Holocaust, FDR State Department, and The Moral Disgrace of an American Aristocracy. And Gregory Wallance joins us from NPR in New York City. Welcome to you, Mr. Wallance.
Well, thank you very, very much. I'm glad to be on the show.
And welcome to you. Good afternoon. Your book is based largely on the relatively unreported epic battle in 1943 between the U.S. State Department and the U.S. Treasury Department. Would you just please tell us about it?
Well, in 1943, with World War II raging, lawyers in the Treasury Department discovered that the State Department had been blocking reports of the Nazi plan to murder every Jewish man, woman, and child on the European continent. And then, even after the reports got out, sabotaging efforts to rescue Jews in Europe in the few places where rescue was possible. And their outrage, and mind you, these lawyers were not Jewish. They were Christians. And their outrage led to a battle, a titanic intergovernmental battle, that ultimately it did two things. At first, it changed the course of American policy towards rescuing Jews in Europe. And second, it averted what would have been damage to America's reputation, a stain on American honor that would have lasted to the end of time.
Describe the leaders of the State Department during the war, Cordell Hull and Sumner Wells, and they were bitter enemies. Why?
Well, the Secretary of State, Cordell Hull, was unqualified for the job. He was a very, very much beloved senator from Tennessee. He'd grown up in a... He'd been born 6 years after the Civil War in 1871. He grew up in a log cabin. He came out of a tradition of feuds in Tennessee. His father had fought a feud over something that occurred during the Civil War. And he entered the State Department never having set foot in the building. He became Secretary of State in 1932. He was insecure. He was a poor manager, poor executive ability, lacking knowledge of foreign affairs. And he had a wife who was Jewish, or of Jewish descent. And as a result, partly because of his inability to control his department, and partly because having a wife of Jewish descent was no asset to someone with political ambition in America at that time, he stayed away from Jewish issues. His Undersecretary of State, Sumner Wells, could not have been more polar opposite. He was a graduate of the Groton School, which is a private school in Massachusetts, a private boarding school, which figures very prominently in my book. Went to Harvard, started a diplomatic career, partly through his connections with Franklin Roosevelt and Eleanor Roosevelt. Sumner Wells had gone to a private school in New York City with Eleanor Roosevelt's younger brother, and that formed a lifelong bond with the Roosevelts. But he was extremely able. He was probably the best diplomat of his generation, and he and Cordell Hull loathed each other. Part of the problem was that Wells was close to the Roosevelts, to Franklin Roosevelt, and went to the White House again and again to discuss foreign policy with FDR. So, and you find that Sumner Wells is giving speeches that a Secretary of State is supposed to give to make when there's a very active and alive Secretary of State in the immediate vicinity. And so Cordell Hull came to loathe him. And no love was lost on him by Sumner Wells. And ultimately, their battle left a vacuum in the State Department, particularly on Jewish issues. And in some respects, and we can talk about that, Sumner Wells was sympathetic to the plight of Jews. But they left a void, their battle, this feud, this fight to the death, as it ultimately turned out to be, left this vacuum into which the career bureaucrats in the State Department stepped in. And they were of a different kind of person than either Hull or Sumner Wells. I don't think of Cordell Hull or Sumner Wells as anti-Semitic, as inhuman. I think they produced or helped to produce a tragedy that neither wanted. But I view the career diplomats, the Foreign Service in particular, diplomats in the State Department, in an entirely different light. And these were men, and they were almost all men, who came from an American aristocracy that has all but vanished. They grew up in a hermetically sealed bubble, cut off from America. They went to these boarding schools and then to Ivy League schools and then diplomatic postings, never having experienced the rest of America. In fact, these boarding schools, in Groton in particular in Massachusetts, is a good example, were established in the 1870s and 1880s as a refuge for the education of wealthy men's sons, the Roosevelt family, the J.P. Morgans, the Harrimans from the railroad, so that they would not have to be educated in the cities that were then being, you know, sort of inundated by immigrants. And the last thing that these wealthy men, these newly rich men, wanted was for their sons to be educated with the urchins as they saw them, the young kids with the smocks and the dirty caps and the fathers with the sheepskin coats coming into Ellis Island. And that was one of the purposes that these schools served. And just to illustrate it, the average tuition at Groton was $600 annually. That was more than the wage two-thirds of American working people made in a year. And so 95% of these students at places like Groton, Exeter, St. Paul's came from this aristocracy, and they were cut off in that bubble, particularly in those boarding schools. They were cut off from the rest of America. They were imbued with an intoxicating sense of Anglo-Saxon exceptionalism, and many of them became mindlessly conformist, a kind of a don't rock the boat mentality. In fact, at Groton, nonconformists, and this meant failing to cheer at a football game or wearing the wrong kind of cap, were waterboarded.
Oh, my God. Mm-hmm.
Literally waterboarded by other students with the approval of the headmaster, Endicott Peabody. And so they come of age in this bubble. They enter diplomatic life. And we'll talk about anti-Semitism, but more than simple anti-Semitism, and they had more than their fair share, they had an attitude towards suffering. It was an indifference, a heartless indifference towards the suffering of people from other ethnic groups or economic backgrounds than their own that was the most striking characteristic I found. And to illustrate what I thought was really so emblematic of the mindset, the head of the Division of European Affairs in the State Department at the outbreak of World War II was a diplomat named J. Pierpont Moffat, a Groton graduate. He'd been a young diplomat stationed in Warsaw at the end of the First World War. At that time, fighting broke out between Soviet armies and Polish armies. Moffat went to the Warsaw train station to see off diplomats from other missions and embassies who were fleeing the city. And he's there, and he sees refugees, the working class and the poor of Warsaw, also trying to flee, trying desperately to get on the train, scrambling, climbing on the trains, trying to get in the windows. That night he goes home and he writes in his diary of what he saw of those refugees. They sounded like so many cackling geese and generally behaved in a manner that made us pray like the Pharisee, "Lord, I thank thee that I am not as other men." And it was that inability to empathize with the sufferings, in particular, of Jews in Europe when the Nazi government put into effect its extermination machinery that I thought was the most striking feature of the State Department's response to the Holocaust, and I think the one that perhaps teaches us the most lessons. I don't think that group exists. The group doesn't exist today, or you can perhaps find a bit of a scent of it in some yacht clubs here and there. And I don't think it's ever likely to exist in the same form. But what the cautionary tale is that there's enormous risk to cutting off an influential group of Americans from the rest of America and then giving them power in a way that they have to make decisions over the fates and lives of their fellow Americans. And what we see today, for example, is a phenomenon called the skyboxification of American life. That was Michael Sendak's term. And he's referring to the fact that, 30, 40 years ago, if you went to a baseball game, at least in some stadiums, the most expensive seats were $3. And the bleachers were $1 or $1.50. And everybody pretty much had the same experience and they sat side by side. That's not true anymore. And our wealthy class, our elite class, increasingly is becoming isolated from the rest of America unless they make a special effort to expose themselves. And I think that there's some risk to a society, particularly a democratic society's cohesion and the sense of we're all in this together, to quote former President Clinton at the Democratic Convention last year, that is something to be avoided. And that's what the story of the State Department in World War II and its response to the Holocaust, in my mind, is very much about.
We're speaking with Gregory Wallins. He's written America's Soul in the Balance, The Holocaust, FDR's State Department, and the Moral Disgrace of an American Aristocracy on today's Topical Currents. Please stay with us. We need to take a short break. We'll be right back.
And we return. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper with you, along with Bonnie Berman. We resume our conversation with Gregory Wallins. He's the author of America's Soul in the Balance. Gregory, let's go back before the entry of the U.S. In the war in 1941. Of course, the Nazis were terribly repressive to Jews from the start, from 1933. But when was the decision made for the, quote, final solution, and when did the Allies know about it?
Well, there's a great deal of debate over when that decision was made, and there's one school which says it predated the beginning of the war. It was always Hitler's plan. They're called the intentionalists. And then there's another school that argues that it sort of evolved as the war, certain events in the war, the occupation of the Soviet Union, which meant that Germany controlled the lives of many, many Jews. And as the war turned against them, Hitler then embarked on this insane scheme. I think it, my sense of it is that it began sometime in 1941 at a meeting between Heinrich Himmler, arguably the number two in the Nazi government, and Rudolf Hess, who became the commandant of Auschwitz. And according to Hess's memoirs, Himmler told Hess that Hitler had given an order that the Jews in Europe were to be destroyed and that they, the SS, were to carry it out. And in terms of when the European or the Western allies, Britain and the United States, learned of this plan, that skip ahead to the following year, July of 1942, July 17th and 18th, to be exact, and Heinrich Himmler makes an inspection trip to Auschwitz. In other words, a year ago, they had discussed the plan. He instructs Hess to start implementing it, and now he wants to see how it is being carried out. And he spends 2 days at Auschwitz. He sees one of the so-called actions, the exterminations, and they were not as nearly as intense or involving the deaths and the murders of so many people as they would become. But by then, Auschwitz was on the way to becoming Auschwitz. And at the end of his two-day inspection trip, he instructs Hess that Eichmann's plan is to be intensified. 11 days later, on July 29th, 1942, a tall, imperious businessman with a pronounced limp boards a train in Breslau, Germany, where he worked for a major German mining concern. Destination Zurich. His name was Edward Schulte. He was not a member of the Nazi Party, but he was a very highly placed businessman with connections to the highest levels of the Nazi government and the Nazi military. And he was and had been for almost 10 years a freelance spy against his own country. He had learned of the plan to invade Poland and provided the exact date on which the invasion would take place to contacts in Switzerland who conveyed that information to the British and French governments. He then again went to Switzerland in 1941 in advance of the German invasion of the Soviet Union. And now, in 1942, he boarded the train to deliver at least a grave and as grave and important a message. Namely, he had learned, and we do not know exactly how he did it, but he had learned of the Nazi plan to exterminate the Jewish peoples of Europe. And he made contact in Switzerland with a Jewish banker. He says to the banker, "I am in possession of information which is incredible but is absolutely authentic." He describes the scheme. "You must get the information," he says to the banker, "to the governments, to Jewish groups in the United States, but also to the governments of the United States and Britain." The banker passes the message to a journalist. The journalist passes the message to the representative of the World Jewish Congress in Switzerland. His name is Gerhard Regner. Gerhard Regner goes to the American consulate in Switzerland with a telegram for the consulate to send via diplomatic pouch to the State Department in Washington to deliver to American Jewish groups. And the State Department refuses to even deliver the telegram. Their response to the request is the information is undoubtedly a war rumor, and even if it were true, there's nothing we could do to be of assistance. Now, Gerhard Regner wisely took the same information to the British diplomats in Switzerland and asked them to give it to a British member of parliament. It was harder for them to refuse to give this kind of information to a British member of parliament. His name was Sidney Silverman, happened to be Jewish. He then had it transmitted by cable to American Jewish groups. They then took the information, and here's this incredible irony. They then take the information to Sumner Wells, who is on the second floor of the State Department. He then conducts an investigation, not realizing that career diplomats right on the floor above him had blocked the information. After several months of investigation through the American diplomats in Switzerland, including getting affidavits from Red Cross officials who knew high-level German officials in the foreign ministry and the war ministry in Berlin, Wells summons Stephen Wise, who's the head of the American Jewish Congress in the United States, to his office. It's November 24th, 1942. And Wise walks into Wells' office, and he sees on Wells' desk cables with bright red seals. And to him, they were his people's blood pouring forth in rivers. And it was a very solemn occasion. And Wells rose and said to Stephen Wise, "Dr. Wise, I hold here in my hand cables I've received from our legation in Switzerland. I regret to inform you that these confirm and justify your deepest fears." And that was the moment when the terrible news was confirmed by the United States government officially, when the terrible news finally penetrated the State Department, and that then set off a round of ferocious campaigning by Jewish groups for rescue of Jews in Europe.
And what ensued?
Well, Rabbi Wise held press conferences, convened a national day of mourning. At the same time, when the State Department was approached by journalists, the State Department bureaucrats, not Sumner Wells, said, "We can't confirm these reports." They even told congressmen who were very disturbed by what they were reading in the newspapers about Rabbi Wise's press accounts, that they said, "We still can't confirm," even though Sumner Wells had officially confirmed them. They have a meeting with Roosevelt, that is, they being Rabbi Stephen Wise and four other leading Jewish American figures, have a meeting with Roosevelt on December 8, 1942, a year and a day since Pearl Harbor. Roosevelt listens. He says, "We already have this information. I'm familiar with it," and promises to issue, and does, a war crime statement vowing to hold the responsible officials in the Nazi government accountable and try them as war criminals when the war is over. Then, in January of 1943, another telegram more information is discovered or found by the World Jewish Congress in Switzerland, Gerhard Regner, taken to the American consulate again in the form of a telegram, transmitted to the State Department. This is absolutely horrific. This was shocking to these people, to the Jewish groups in particular, beyond all words, because this information coming from Switzerland was 6,000 Jews are being killed daily at a single location in Poland. This time, the State Department, after sitting on the information when it reaches Washington from their diplomats in Switzerland, decides to give the information to Rabbi Wise. I think they felt at this point, with now public knowledge of the massacres, of the exterminations, it would be risky for them to withhold the information. So they give the information to Rabbi Wise. It's given to Rabbi Wise on February 9th, 1943. The next day, the State Department sends a diplomatic cable, back to the diplomats, the minister, equivalent of an ambassador, in Switzerland, the U.S. diplomats. And this cable instructs them not to send any more reports like the one they had just received. In effect, the State Department was attempting to cover up the greatest murder, the greatest mass murder, the greatest crime in human history. And the reason they did it, I think, was they were concerned that these campaigns for rescue, including mass rallies attended by tens of thousands of people in Madison Square Garden and in other cities, were creating too much pressure for rescue. They were opposed to rescue. In their minds, even if they succeeded in getting people out of Europe, Jews out of Europe, there would be no place to put them. But simultaneously with these two cables, a genuine opportunity arises to rescue Jews in Europe. On February 2nd, 1943, Germany surrendered, the 6th German Army surrenders at Stalingrad, a cataclysmic defeat for Nazi Germany, the turning point in the war. One of Nazi Germany's armies was Romania, and Romania suffered 160,000, killed, wounded, or missing in the Battle of Stalingrad. 2 weeks later, the Romanian government makes a public offer to allow 70,000 Jews, Romanian Jews, who had been marched forcibly out of Romania into a part of the Ukraine now occupied by Romania, a gift, if you will, from the Nazi Germany that conquered the Ukraine, and left there to die. And I think that Romania, and this is the perception of historians, is that Romania was now fearful that Germany would not win the war and was seeking to ameliorate what would otherwise be extremely harsh peace terms. And so they made this offer to free, well, originally Romania had marched 130,000 Jews into this location called Transnistria. It was between the Transdniester and the Bug Rivers. And there were only about 60 or 70,000 still left alive by February of 1943. And so this offer was made to ease harsh peace terms. The offer was confirmed by diplomatic sources in Romania after an investigation by the State Department, and the World Jewish Congress, through Gerhard Regner, who had originally gotten the news that had been given to him by Edward Schulte out to the world of the exterminations, puts together a rescue plan. But the rescue plan required the payment of money to the Romanian government, which said, we'll free these Jews, but we want $50 a Jew. It was a ransom, in effect. That kind of financial transaction during the war required the approval of the Treasury Department. And Rabbi Stephen Wise went to Roosevelt, and he describes to Roosevelt the rescue plan, and he says, Mr. President, I hesitate to raise this, but I did not want to go to the Treasury Department until I had first discussed it with you, but we will need Treasury Department approval because this will involve paying monies potentially to a government of an ally of Nazi Germany.
Gregory Wallen's, we need to be taking a short break, but we get back to your story in just a few moments. Gregory Wallen's is the author of America's Soul in the Balance. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to Topical Currents on this Monday. Bonnie Berman here with Joseph Cooper and Gregory Wallens, who's written America's Soul in the Balance, The Holocaust, FDR's State Department, and The Moral Disgrace of an American Aristocracy. If you'd like to join in the conversation, if you have a question for Gregory Wallens, the number to call is 1-800-743-9576. That's 1-800-743-WLRN. Or you can email radio@WLRN.org. So you were telling us about what happened in Transnistria. Do you want to continue now with your story?
Yeah, so Stephen Wise describes the ransom proposal to Roosevelt and explains that it will need Treasury Department approval. On the spot, Roosevelt picks up the phone, gets Secretary of the Treasury Henry Morgenthau III, Henry Morgenthau Jr. on the phone, and says to him, "Henry, I'm with Stephen. He makes a very fair proposal about ransoming Jews." And immediately it has Roosevelt's approval. It has Morgenthau's, in particular his lawyers, his staff lawyers, instantly give approval to it, and nothing happens. And months go by, and these lawyers in the Treasury Department, Randolph Paul, Hosiah DuBois Jr., Ansel Luxford, John Peel, tough bureaucratic fighters dedicated to defeating Hitler, unaccustomed to failure, grow increasingly angry. And they begin an investigation of the State Department. Very improper, highly unofficial. And I'm a former federal prosecutor, and I instantly recognized some real experts at work, some very skillful lawyers, because they found, in effect, informants in the State Department, officials who had resigned in anger at what the State Department was doing in response to pleas for rescuing Jews in Europe. They managed to get one insider to give them the cables that I described earlier, the one that reported on 6,000 Jews dying daily, and then the one that the State Department sent back to its diplomats in Switzerland saying, don't send any more reports like that. And those cables were obtained at the end of December 1943, and that was really the turning point. That's what broke this open, because the Treasury lawyers were shocked by this, because it was so illuminating of a mindset. At this point, of course, there was more information about the exterminations. It was official American policy to try those as those responsible in the Nazi government as war criminals. And there they discover that the State Department was trying to block reports of the exterminations, cover them up, if you will, and also had delayed sending the license that was needed to put into effect the ransom plan to save the lives of tens of thousands of Romanian Jews. And ultimately, they persuade Henry Morgenthau, the Secretary of the Treasury, who's Jewish, to go to Roosevelt. Now, I found Henry Morgenthau one of the fascinating characters in the story because he came from his family. His father had been the ambassador to the Ottoman Empire and had gotten very involved in trying to alleviate the plight, alleviate the massacres of Armenians in the latter part of the 19th century and the early part of the 20th century. Morgenthau himself was absolutely dedicated to defeating Hitler. He had a hiring policy that one person described as asking a simple question or two of the candidate for a job in the Treasury Department. Does he hate Hitler? Does he want to lick Hitler's guts? And he assembles a first-rate legal staff all dedicated to doing just that. At the same time, he's very close to Franklin Roosevelt, but Franklin Roosevelt was not easy on anyone close to him, particularly his cabinet officers. Morgenthau, after he left government, said that Roosevelt left you with the feeling that you could never be sure that you would have your job the next morning. And he manipulated his cabinet officers. He deceived them. He was in many ways, for all his sparkling personality, he was an absolutely ruthless politician. And he would say things to Morgenthau like, I never know. This is Roosevelt speaking. I never let my left hand know what my right hand is doing. Morgenthau said, "Well, Mr. President, which hand am I?" "Well, Henry, you're my right hand, but I keep my left under the table." And it was in that state of perpetual insecurity that Morgenthau existed and had to manage this relationship. And one of the things that Morgenthau was greatly fearful of was that he would get too far out front of Roosevelt and the country on Jewish issues and bring down on Roosevelt an attack by anti-Semites. And at this time in American history, and it's not comfortable to think about, there were over 100 overtly anti-Semitic organizations operating in America. So when this ransom proposal lands on his desk and his lawyers come to him, outraged at the State Department's delay, he's caught between these two enormous conflicting forces.
Gregory,
his desire...
Gregory Wallen, let's just pause a little bit and also let's take a couple of phone calls, if you would. It's a fascinating story you're telling. This is Alejandro...
Yes, good afternoon.
Coral Springs. Hi.
Indeed, good afternoon. I'm a South American by birth, and I started my career in the south of Brazil, where I met Dr. Riegner when he visited. He was German by birth, and even in his older years, looked the way you and I would like to look when we are 50.
And I agree.
Yes, indeed. And he was a short guy, always very... very classy in his clothing, and in the 1970s, my late father coincided with him at a conference in Peru, and he brought back the story that Dr. Riegner, his main task at the time was to locate and recycle Jewish children that, by virtue of having been given to Christian institutions, were no longer Jews. That's why I use the term recycle.
Any comment, Gregory?
Yeah, that's fascinating. You know, I was always struck by the fact that Riegner never married.
That's
never
correct.
Had children.
Mm-hmm.
And he devoted his life to human rights, to the cause of human rights. Obviously, to the cause of Jews in wartime Europe. But even after that, it was his lifelong dedication.
He worked under Nachum Goldman in the World Jewish Congress.
In the World Jewish Congress, he was hired by Goldman to staff the Geneva office, and that's why, and he developed a good reputation, and that's why the bearers of this terrible message delivered by Edward Schulte came to him, and he was the one who ultimately managed to get the information out to the world.
Mm-hmm.
But he is an inspirational figure. And what you're describing is, and I didn't know that story, is completely consistent with his dedication to human rights causes, but in particular, the Jewish people.
Gregory Wallens, how about Eleanor Roosevelt in this? She was such a great humanitarian, certainly had the ear of the president. Was she apprised of this situation even before the president?
I don't think she knew before FDR knew. And she was active in some areas. She gave support to Jewish groups. She actually interceded to get refugees on a ship called the Kwanzaa, which had been blocked from entering the U.S. onto American shores. And she saved 80 or more lives directly through her intervention. But I think she never did as much as, at least in retrospect, she thought she should have, and one of her sons said that her failure to rescue Jews, to ease the plight of Jews in Europe, was one of her greatest regrets in her life.
I'd like to ask you where FDR stood in the battle, but we need to take another short break. We're speaking with Gregory Wallens on today's Topical Currents. He's written America's Soul in the Balance. We'll take that break, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to today's Topical Currents. Bonnie Berman here with Joseph Cooper and Gregory Wallens, who's written America's Soul in the Balance, The Holocaust, FDR State Department, and the Moral Disgrace of an American Aristocracy. So, Mr. Wallens, what was FDR doing while the Treasury Department and the State Department were battling?
Well, he was managing a world war being fought on six continents with 10 million Americans in uniform, more than half of them overseas. And that sort of creates sort of the two polar opposites, if you will, with Franklin Roosevelt. On the one hand, he did more than almost anyone to defeat Nazi Germany. He prepared the country to deal militarily and otherwise to face and to ultimately militarily vanquish Nazi Germany, which put an end to the exterminations and saved the lives of perhaps somewhere in the neighborhood of the 2 million surviving Jews in Europe. He did it through Lend-Lease at a time when no one in America wanted to be caught in a world war. He was the one who was keeping England in the game and preserving what became this vital base for the Normandy D-Day invasions. On the other hand, he did not control the State Department. He allowed the State Department to erect these visa barriers to refugees before the war, which were tightened even more after the war. And while he did approve the rescue plan that I described earlier, and ultimately when Henry Morgenthau finally went to Roosevelt to tell him what the State Department had been doing, and this is now January of 1944, he created the War Refugee Board, which is credited with saving 200,000 Jewish lives. The unfortunate aspect is that it was not enough, too late. More could have been done had he been more aggressive on this issue earlier. But above all, I think he missed a moral opportunity. I think he didn't grasp, for all his farsighted vision, he didn't grasp what it was that the Nazis were doing and why it was not just a human cataclysm but a moral cataclysm for mankind. He never, for example, personally spoke, such as on his fireside chats, to condemn and explain to the American people what facts, what they had discovered about this terrible conduct, to condemn it and to explain that this was at least one reason why so many young Americans were being sent in harm's way.
Why do you think that he didn't mention?
I think it was a couple of things. I mean, he was so focused on winning the war, which is what you would want him to be, that almost every consideration apart from that fell by the wayside. I think even today, as I was reading these materials, reading about this meeting between Himmler and Rudolf Hess, you stop every now and then, you say, I can't believe this happened. And right. Back in 1944, it was even harder for them to believe it could be taking place. And I think it was a combination of that, but nonetheless, here's the contrast. Abraham Lincoln, during the Civil War, focused on winning that war, grasped the moral issue that had emerged by at least 1863 and understood how the country was being changed and how it was being changed in a way that went right to its very moral core. And that was the New Birth of Freedom, part of the Gettysburg Address. And he somehow got it. He was able to see beyond simply the immediate carnage, the immediate challenge, and see it in a more transcendent light. And Roosevelt, great crisis manager, but somehow could not grasp this moral dimension. And so I think he lost the opportunity to save lives, and he lost the opportunity to establish a lasting moral legacy for himself.
Do you think, I mean, has the State Department ever acknowledged these events and apologized for them?
Not in any official way. And that's unfortunate, because I think they should. The German government commissioned a report on the complicity of the German foreign ministry in the Holocaust, and it was a very scathing report that revealed a lot of conduct not previously known. I won't compare the State Department in any way to what was going on in Germany or with German diplomats. But nonetheless, I think it's something that could use some official exploration because, again, I think it's important for us to keep in mind what we've learned from that. And one thing we've learned, I think, is the saying in the Talmud, to save one life is as if you have saved your own. And in a lot of respects, the fight between the Treasury Department and the State Department over rescuing victims of genocide was a precursor to battles that have been fought since over places like Darfur or Bosnia or Libya and so forth. And while America can't intervene in every genocidal conflict, we have to do what we can do. And that's the lesson of the battle between the Treasury Department and the State Department in World War II.
Gregory Wallens, do you have a website associated with you and the book?
Yes, AmericaSoulInTheBalance.com. And it has a lot of materials, photographs, a timeline, comments on the book, a blog, and so forth.
You know, I read the account of the debate between you and the senior historian at the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum, and I found it very interesting. On what basis does he disagree with you about holding the State Department accountable for its conduct in blocking the rescue of Jews during the Holocaust?
His analysis was a kind of a hindsight analysis, and he didn't dispute the facts that I've described to you. But what that particular historian argued was, well, the State Department's conduct didn't have any impact. And he said, well, first, most of the Jews who were going to die in Transnistria, the Romanian Jews, by the time this battle, intergovernmental battle began, were already dead. They would have had to run risks to escape. It's not clear that there was shipping that would have been available, and probably the German government would have blocked it anyway. Hmm. Now, I think he's wrong factually, and I think he's wrong because, first, there were at least 7,000 or 8,000 Jews who did die, according to the most conservative counting, during the 1943 when this battle, this bureaucratic battle, was going on. And by another accounting, it was as many as 20,000. And, of course, the Jews who survived were nonetheless treated horribly. Second, when the War Refugee Board did mount a rescue, and that sort of brings you to the end of the story, they did rescue the surviving 50 or 60,000 in Transnistria. They did it despite and overcoming the opposition of the German government, including Adolf Eichmann. They chartered private ships to take these Jews across the sea to Palestine. And the Jews were absolutely willing to run risk to get out of the hell that was Europe. And I think the problem with his analysis is that if you can just, if you do an after-the-fact justification or rationale for failing to rescue, that will easily slip into a before-the-fact failure to justify doing anything. Well, we shouldn't rescue the Jews, even though there's some possibility we might save lives because, well, most of them may be already dead, or we may not find the way to get them out, or it's possible the government and the country they're in, or Jews or anyone else who's the victim of genocide, or these people may not get out because the government won't allow it, or they'll have to run risks. And that could be applied to all of these conflicts and all of these genocidal events that I just referred to, and it becomes, in effect, a rationale for doing nothing.
I don't accept that. Gregory Wallens, we've just about run out of time. I certainly want to thank you. Once again, the website associated with the book?
AmericaSoulInTheBalance.com.
He is the author.
Thank you very much.
Attorney and writer, Gregory Wallens. He's the author of America's Soul in the Balance, The Holocaust, FDR, State Department, and the Moral Disgrace of an American Aristocracy. Of course, Mr. Wallens joined us from NPR Studios in New York City. We certainly want to thank you, Mr. Wallens, for spending this hour with us.
And I'm very grateful for the opportunity to do that.
Thank you so much.
And that wraps up today's edition. Apologies to those callers we couldn't get on the air. Our producer is Richard Ive. Technical direction from Caroline Brader Watts. Paul Leary is online producer. Tomorrow's program is with Kennesaw State University sociology professor Melvin Fine. He's written Post-Liberalism, The End of a Dream. Fine says that despite an appearance of vigor, liberalism is dying and is not the wave of the future. You can find free audio archives and downloads of this and past programs at our website, that's WLRN.org, new and improved, and follow us on the Topical Currents Facebook page as well for author and book links. Today's will be up this afternoon. And today's calendar, on this day in 1902, 111 years ago, the birth of Charles Lindbergh in Detroit. His May 1927 solo flight in the Spirit of St. Louis made him a world hero. Le Bourget Field. And on this day in 1913, 100 years ago, the birth of civil rights legend Rosa Parks in Tuskegee, Alabama. She was 42 in 1955 when she refused to give up a seat for a white bus rider in Montgomery, Alabama. Now we ponder the Stockholm Syndrome. On this day in 1974, 39 years ago, newspaper heiress Patty Hearst is kidnapped by the Symbionese Liberation Army. She was physically and sexually abused, but still served 2 years for a bank robbery conviction. Jimmy Carter commuted that sentence, and in one of his last presidential acts, Bill Clinton pardoned Patty Hearst. And we leave with a quote from her. I had been held in the closet for 2 months, and you know, abused in all manner of ways. I was very good at doing what I was told. This is Joseph Cooper along with Bonnie Berman. Thanks for making Public Radio your companion today. Stay tuned now for the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.